kids, older allergies. Oh, gosh.
All right, good morning, everybody. I think we'll go ahead and get started. We're now on the record. Let the record show that it is 9 a.m. on August 31st, 2015. We are present in the commission hearing room in the state capitol in Bismarck, North Dakota, for the public hearing in the matter of the application of Montana Dakota Utilities Company, a division of MDU Resources Group, Inc., for a natural gas service rate increase. This is case number PU-15-90. My name is Wade Mann, and I am the procedural administrative law judge designated to preside over this hearing. Also present today are the members of the Public Service Commission, Commission Chair Julie Fedorchak, Commissioner Randy Christman, and Commissioner Brian Kalk. And I'll call on the commissioners shortly for opening comments after we go through some of the preliminary matters. At this time, I'll have the parties note their appearances for the record, beginning with the applicant.
Dan Kuntz, MDU Resources Group, 1200 West Century Avenue, Bismarck, North Dakota.
Mr. Kuntz, can you just identify who you have at the table?
Also with me is Nicole Cavisto, the Montana Dakota President and Chief Executive Officer, and Paul Sanderson, who also will be co-counsel with me today.
Okay. And representing Commission Advocacy Staff?
John Chu on behalf of Advocacy Staff. Along with me today is Utility Analyst Victor Shook and Director of Economic Regulation Michael Diller. And if needed telephonically, we do have Aaron Rothschild, our consultant for the cost capital.
Okay. And representing Commission Advisory Staff?
Ilana Jeffcoat-Sacco.
Okay.
And eventually with me today will be Jerry Lean.
Okay.
But I don't see him right now.
All right.
His stuff is there, though.
And we also have two interveners who are parties to this matter. The first one is AARP, representing AARP.
Yes, John B. Kaufman, 871 Tuxedo Boulevard, St. Louis, Missouri. I also have with me Josh Askvig, who is the Associate State Director of AARP North Dakota.
Okay. And the other intervener is Federal Executive Agencies. Who do we have on behalf of FEA?
Yes, sir. My name is Thomas Jernigan, and I'm here with our expert, Brian Collins.
Okay.
From BAI.
All right. The notice of continued hearing that was filed in this case on May 27, 2015, summarizes the relevant procedural background leading up to today's hearing, and it also identifies the two issues for consideration at the hearing. The first is what rates and charges are necessary to provide a just and reasonable rate of return on MDU's property used and useful for the service and convenience of the public in North Dakota. And two, are MDU's proposed rate schedules designed in such a manner that they result in a basis of charge to its customers that is just and reasonable without discrimination? Before getting into the actual hearing, we'll just briefly address procedure for today's hearing. MDU, as the applicant, will present its case first. Any witnesses called by MDU will be subject to cross-examination by counsel for advocacy staff, also then questioning by commission advisory staff and the commissioners, and then followed by any questioning from the intervener, counsel for the interveners, AARP and FEA. Once MDU completes its case, advocacy staff will present its case in the same procedure will be followed. Then after that, AARP will have the opportunity to present its case, and then FEA. Once the interveners complete their cases, if there are any members of the public who would like to come forward and offer any testimony, they'll have the opportunity to do so at that time. No decision will be reached on the matter today. The proceedings are being digitally recorded and will be available for later review. Before we get into the opening comments of the commissioners in the hearing, are there any preliminary matters that should be addressed at this time? Mr. Kuntz?
Your Honor, in front of you and on the witness stand are the company's three-ring binder with all of its exhibits that have been pre-marked in this case, exhibits MDU 1 through 14. They include the application as MDU Exhibit 1, the direct and rebuttal testimony of the witnesses, which would be exhibits 2 through 10. The settlement agreement that was filed last week, a copy of that is included as Exhibit 11. Ms. Cavisto and Ms. Averly will be presenting short PowerPoints in conjunction with the summary of their direct testimony. Those are marked as exhibits at MDU 12 and 13. And finally, we were requested to prepare a residential bill comparison under various scenarios. That's been marked as MDU Exhibit 14. We would offer those at this time, Your Honor.
Mr. Hsu, any objection to admitting MDU's exhibits up front at this time?
No objection, Your Honor.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No objection, thank you.
Mr. Kaufman? Any objection to admission of the exhibits?
No objection.
Mr. Jernigan?
No objection.
Okay. MDU's exhibits 1 through 14 will be admitted into the record at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor. We have nothing further on procedurally.
All right. Mr. Hsu, anything?
Your Honor, similarly, we have four exhibits that have already been passed out. They should be in the manila folder. PSC exhibits 1 through 4. PSC 1 through 3, they are the pre-filed testimony for the witnesses today. And PSC 4 is illustrative guide to Mr. Dillard's testimony here today. At this time, we would just like to request they be admitted.
Okay. Mr. Kuntz, any objection?
No objection.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle, any objection to the admission of the PSC exhibits at this time? Okay. Mr. Kaufman?
Based on the understanding that we'll be allowed some cross-examination on rate design,
certainly.
Subject to that cross-examination, we have no objection to the admission of the pre-filed testimony.
Okay. Mr. Jernigan?
No objection.
All right. PSC advocacy staff's exhibits 1 through 4 will also be admitted into the record at this time. Anything else, Mr. Hsu, at this time?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman, anything?
No, Your Honor.
Mr. Jernigan?
Similarly, the FEA has passed out a small packet about this size. It is the testimony of Brian Collins with exhibits, and we would move that it be admitted at this time as well.
Is this a single exhibit, Mr. Jernigan?
Yes, it is, along with his attachments.
Okay. Mr. Kuntz, any objection to, I guess I will, I'll identify this as FEA exhibit number one, if that's all right. And Mr. Kuntz, any objection to admission of FEA exhibit one at this time?
No objection.
Okay. Mr. Hsu?
Objection, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No objection.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman?
No objection.
Okay. FEA exhibit number one will be admitted at this time as well. Let's see. At this time, I will take opening comments from the commissioners. I believe this is Commissioner Kalk's portfolio. Okay, you can go ahead.
All right, thank you, Honor. Your Honor, start off on a light note, just thank everyone for being here today. I know it takes a lot of work to get to this point. Over the weekend, I'm sure many of you followed the Bison football, and I have to start off with that because this is Montana Dakota Utilities Company. So I'm going to ask the first question will be, who did you support in the game, Montana or North Dakota? I was on the phone with the Montana commissioner over the weekend, not talking about rate cases, but talking about the football game. But the reason I set that up is that, you know, the issues between states often are issues that are overlooked. We look at the company issues. But right now, Mr. Lean was stepped out making some phone calls because the issues going on in North Dakota right now between states as far as cost allocation on transmission, as far as what this cost that a clean power plan may or may not be for the state. We talk about the costs that are involved today. I want my colleagues in the media and friends to be tracking that as well because the costs that might be facing customers from those kind of things will far exceed anything that we're talking about today. So I really appreciate everyone coming out today, but I wanted to set the stage that there's a lot going on in the energy industry from you build something new, you get rate return. There's cost allocation between states. There's federal rules that are coming into play that this commission is going to be heavily involved in, and we need all of you out there to participate in those discussions. As far as coming down a little bit closer to home today for the rate case, for many years, you know, prior to me being on the commission and even for my colleagues here, that there wasn't a lot of rate cases in front of the Public Service Commission. We'd every 4, 5, 6, 8 years, sometimes rate cases would come in because nobody was building anything. It was kind of status quo out there. But when you've got companies out there like MDU that are aggressively building things to meet the needs of a growing state, you know, we have these hearings that we approve this plant, we do this, we do that. It's just a matter of time till the companies will come back and request return on those investments. So that's really kind of the setup of why we're here today. Now, we've got different interveners in the group that have your issues that you want to bring out, and I appreciate you doing that. For the members of the public and the media, the interveners have a, I won't say it, in my mind, really, it's not much different than somebody from the public coming in and saying their piece, but it's a different legal setting, quite honestly, of what they have access to in a settlement agreement or if there's appeal on this order. But for me, I do appreciate the interveners coming in here, but also the public testimony that we have received and will receive, that's also very important. The couple other things that I wanted to look at down, the I think the big thing for me is we've got 2 days scheduled for these hearings. And the fact that we've had Montana-Dakota Utilities in front of us a lot in the past because of their growth, we know the company, we know their rate design, we know the issues that we've dealt with before. I believe I understand the concerns of the interveners. The big thing for me will be to flush out these hearings in the next couple days and ask some questions about some things maybe that may have popped up. But then at the end of the day, get to a good, robust discussion with my colleagues and make the best decision. But whatever happens today, it won't be the end of this. MDU is going to keep building things. The state is going to continue to grow. So as we look at the rate design issues and as we look at what the other issues come out, I think it's important that we look at what we've done in the past and we look at an eye in the future of how we may have to change things and understand the world around us is changing quite a bit. And for the company, just one thing that I haven't talked about in the past that has come up is just the issue of how we notify customers when you do planned outages and restarts on gas. I know that we talked about that as a potential periodic information exchange topic, but we pulled it off because it was pretty close to the rate case. So that's the one thing that might be different that I haven't talked about in the past. So just thank everyone for being here today and look forward to a good couple days of hearings.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Good morning, everyone. I won't talk about the Bison loss this weekend, although I am proud to see Commissioner Kulk still wearing his Bison tartan. It was sad nonetheless, even for this Fighting Sioux fan. Anyway, glad to see so many folks here, some members of the media don't always show up for these sort of laborious formal hearings. But I think it's good that you're here and good that the interveners are here as well, because this is really kind of where the rubber hits the road on a regulated monopoly. You're here to seek a rate increase, and this is the process laid out for that endeavor. We've got the various parties. We've got the company making their case. We've got the advocacy staff really looking out for customers. And then we have two interveners in this case. And we're really the ones responsible for coming to a balance in the end of meeting all the various needs. I think it's interesting. I always try to bring it down to the points, and I like that Judge Mann always starts out with the, you know, really what are we here for, laying out the very specific reasons noted in our public notice. And it really comes down to coming to a decision that's just reasonable and without discrimination, just as in justified, the company needs this money, reasonable as in fair, doesn't overly burden customers, but it also allows the company and its investors to make a reasonable return on their investment, which is a real part of this process. And then without discrimination, that gets down to the rate design. And those really come down to really the core issues, even to this day, with the settlement agreement in front of us. A lot of those issues in terms of what's needed in revenue has been ironed out between the parties and even agreed to by at least one of the interveners. So it's gone from $4.3 million to $2.5 million in terms of the overall revenue increase needed. So that's a substantial reduction. I think that's a good step in the right direction. There's some of the more controversial components. The rate stabilization plan has been eliminated, so that's and agreed to by at least three of the parties. And so rate design is one of the big issues that remains not agreed to by all the parties who have intervened. So I think that's really where our focus will probably end up, although I have questions on some of the other issues as well, and I appreciate the company providing some of the information even last week that was requested. So really look forward to a good hearing today. Don't know if we'll have to be back tomorrow. I guess we'll see. If not, we all get a free day on our calendar to do other work that stacks up when we end up in these long meetings. So thanks, everybody, and look forward to a really productive hearing.
Commissioner Christman?
I want to spin off of one of the things that Commissioner Kalk mentioned, and it's not the football game either because it's the Bisongrad. I don't want to talk about that. But you mentioned the Clean Power Plan. And so for those who are listening in on to our meetings today or here in person and are concerned about the rate increase and how it affects yourself or how it affects the group that you represent in an adverse way by seeing energy costs go up. I know that there we're talking more about electricity and here we're talking more about gas, but it's all energy. And if this is concerning to you, then you need to be speaking out about the Clean Power Plan, because if we are to implement it as proposed in the 2020s decade, we're going to be looking back fondly at these kind of rate increases and working on much larger ones in that decade. One of the things that I hope is explored, and I just throw this kind of, rather than trying to guess who to throw the question to, I'll throw it out and hopefully among the sides it will be explored. It seems to me in the 2.5 years I've been here and the small amount of rate cases we've had, it seems like, and I don't mean this in a negative way, it's just I don't know of a better term for it. It seems like there's always an increase and a diversion. And in this case, the basic service charge is going up on residential, but remember the distribution delivery charge would go away. So I find myself wondering, well, how come we have the distribution delivery charge? Is that something that the commission imposed on the company one time, or did the company think it was a good idea then but now thinks it's not such a good idea, or is it just a diversion and in a rate case or two down the road we're going to be coming back and saying, well, there's no increase in the basic service charge, but we're just implementing this new distribution delivery charge? So I'm wondering not just what we're doing here or looking at doing, but how did we get to this point when there's changes? So I hope that will be explored as well. Last thing I want to say is, as odd as it might seem, with almost a week of upper 90s degree days, I've come down with a cold. And so I'm going to try and be greedy and not share it. If I start coughing too much or something, I'm probably just going to exit the room and go and monitor this from another room. Please don't think it means that I'm off doing something else and not watching this. This is the only thing on my schedule for these 2 days, and I will be monitoring it, but I may be monitoring it from another office.
Thank you. Before we get into MDU's case, let's allow an opportunity for opening statements by any of the parties. Mr. Kuntz, do you have an opening statement?
Briefly, Your Honor, just to let you know our plans for our presentation. Our first witness today will be Nicole Cavisto, our President and CEO of Montana Dakota. Ms. Cavisto will present her pre-filed testimony. She has a PowerPoint slide that she'll use in summarizing her pre-filed direct testimony. Ms. Cavisto will also introduce the settlement agreement that was reached last week, or week before, I guess, filed last week, between the company and advocacy staff that was joined by the FEA and joined in part and opposed in part by the AARP, but she'll be available to explain the key elements of that particular document. And then after that, we'll offer our other five witnesses. In each case, we'll ask the witness to summarize their pre-filed direct testimony and be available for cross-examination. At the end, the last witness will be Ms. Averly, who will be testifying on revenue allocation and rate design. She also has a PowerPoint presentation. The slides from her presentation are in the three-ring binder, as well as Ms. Cavisco's presentation have been marked as exhibits. So those will be available to you as well. So that's our plans for the presentation, Your Honor. Other than that, we don't have anything further in open.
Thank you. Mr. Hsu?
Yes, Your Honor. Similarly, we will be presenting the settlement agreement as well. Victor Shook will be go up there and walking it through with the commission. He'll be open for questions as well. Mr. Diller will be taking the stand as well, and he's going to be speaking towards the rate structure and some of the controversial issues that Mr. Commissioner Crisman was speaking about earlier. And Aaron Rothschild will be available telephonically also if the commission would like to hear from him as well.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, did you have anything in opening?
No, I do not. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman?
Yes, thank you. AARP is here today with a couple of contested issues with regard to the rate design. We're very pleased that after the settlement conference, many of the issues are not in dispute. We are not raising any objection to the settlement agreement except for what would be found under paragraph 8, which is the manner in which the rate increase would be applied to the customer classes and within the residential class. That could be broken up into two issues. As far as the allocation amongst the different customer classes, we feel that the proposal is a little bit heavy on the residential customer class. The increase would be roughly 3.3% to the residential class, whereas overall the increase would only be 1.9%, while large industrial customers would receive no increase and the Air Force would receive a decrease. We are here urging that the Commission look at that and apply a little more moderation, a little more gradualism to that allocation of the increase amongst the resident classes. And then maybe a little more controversial is how the increase would be applied within the residential class. Currently, there is a rate structure for MDU that includes a fixed charge and a usage or volumetric charge. And we were here not as interveners, but we were here commenting last year, or maybe a year and a few months ago, in this room when the commission was deliberating on that very charge. At that time, the fixed charge portion of the bill was only about $9 a month, and the utility was trying to turn the delivery gas delivery portion of the bill to a fixed charge. The commission reached a compromise at that time, whereas now the fixed charge is about, I believe it's $14.80, depending on how many days there are in the month. So it went from $9 to $14.80. And then here today we're talking again about going all the way to a fixed charge with no volumetric or no usage portion. And AARP doesn't believe that's fair, and we would like to see that the volumetric portion of the delivery part of the gas still remain. We think that there is a place for a fixed charge as well as for a usage, and we think there should be a balance there. If the settlement agreement is successful on this point, the basic fixed mandatory basic service charge would be $19.60, so that would be more than a doubling over a period of 2 years. And again, on that point, we are urging the commission to moderate that somewhat. We believe that it's important that the delivery gas rate includes some usage component, both to be fair to small users and to also give customers more control over their bills. We are concerned about the smallest users, the users that scrimp and save and do the best they can to keep their bills affordable. And we believe that going to a fixed charge would take away the economic benefit that they see for their conservation efforts. So that's it in a nutshell, and we'll look forward to asking a few questions on those points.
Thank you. Thank you. Mr. Jernigan?
Yes, sir. The FEA is here today. We will be presenting the testimony of Mr. Collins, and he will be here to support the settlement in full and take any questions with that the commissioners may have this time.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Kuntz, are you ready to call
to proceed, Your Honor.
Okay.
We'll call Nicole Caviso to the stand.
Mr. Ms. Cavisto, before you testify, I'm required to give you an oath, and I need to advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It's a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. And being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay.
Ms. Cavisto, would you please state your name and business address?
Nicole Cavisto, 400 North 4th Street.
And what is your position?
I'm the president and CEO of Montana Dakota Utilities, as well as Cascade, Intermountain, and Great Plains.
Could you give the commission a brief background of your educational and work experience, please?
Sure. I graduated from the Minnesota State University Moorhead with an accounting degree in 1995, and I've been with MD Resources, our parent company, and or Montana Dakota Great Plains for 20 years. When I left our corporate office, I was the vice president, chief accounting officer, and I joined the utility as the vice president of operations, served in that capacity for 1 year, and started my new role here in January of this year as president and CEO of Montana Dakota.
And Ms. Cavisto, did you file pre-filed direct testimony in this case?
I did.
I want to point you to the binder that's in front of you and point to Exhibit MDU-2. Do you see that document?
I do.
And is that a copy of your pre-filed direct testimony?
It is.
And do you have any corrections or additions to that testimony?
I do not.
So if I ask you the questions that appear there today, would your answers be the same?
Yes.
And do you have a summary? Can you provide the summary of your pre-filed direct testimony to the commission? And I understand you have a PowerPoint presentation to go along with that summary. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And the slides for that presentation have been marked as MDU-12. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Yeah, I'd like you to proceed with your summary then.
All right, thank you. I just want to walk through the overview of our originally filed case as well as the settlement agreement that's in front of the commission here. So I'll start here by just talking through the original application, which was filed in February of 2015. At that point, Montana Dakota was requesting an increase of $4.3 million, which represents an overall increase of $3.4 million. It was a change in distribution rates only. And our last case, just as a reminder, was filed in 2013 with final rates implemented in May of 2014. A little bit of background in terms of the primary reason for the increase. As you can see here on the slide, and as it was alluded to in the opening remarks, we have had unprecedented growth in the North Dakota territory. And you can see our projected 2015 investment was at around $212 million, which did represent a 15% increase over the 2014 test year that was presented in the last case. In addition to that, along with investment comes increased taxes and depreciation, and we also have seen some increases in our O&M. This was offset, and you can see the chart on the bottom of the slide indicating the growth in our customers, and so some of that was offset by customer growth, but not in its entirety. When looking at the investment, just providing some indication on where we've put the investment, the large pieces that are driving the investment increase are Newtown border stations, distribution mains and services to support the system, and then we did and have in the forecast the Williston Loop Line, the second phase of the Williston Loop Line. So those are the primary projects driving the increased need. This map here, although a little bit hard to see, provides some perspective on our system growth across our various major communities in North Dakota. And you can see in the different colors where we've got represented the growth. I've got 2010 and 2011 is represented, I believe, in red. I'm just going to confirm that by looking at mine. Nope, that's in blue. 2010 and 2011, are represented in blue, so you can see some of our growth in blue in those years. Red on the map is our 2012 and 2013 growth, and then green is 2014 and what we're projecting here in 2015. So this map just provides some perspective on our system growth throughout North Dakota. This slide here then shows how our rate base as a result of that growth has grown since 2005 into our test year of 2015. On the cost side of the equation, Montana Dakota has always been very prudent in trying to keep our O&M costs down as we grow the system. We have done such by adding efficiencies such as technology improvements and that, and you can see that over time we have kept our O&M per customer pretty much flat here with 2005. There's been a couple years where that has been slightly different. But when you look at this, I think it's pretty impressive as you look at our growth over the system, how we've been able to control our O&M, while during that same time frame, the consumer price index has increased by 25%. So the settlement agreement, what's represented in the settlement agreement, as alluded to in the opening remarks, the increase of 4.3 has been reduced to 2.6. This would represent a 2% overall increase in rates. Included in that is a 9.5% return on equity. We did an update on in firm volumes and an increase in the interruptible sales distribution margin. We had some reductions in O&M in the settlement. And the fixed charge rate for residential customers is a topic that we will be discussing further. And then the rate stabilization mechanism was withdrawn in the settlement agreement. So final slide here. I'll just talk to how that proposed increase is divvied up via the different customer classes. You can see residential up 3.3, Air Force down 1.6, and small interruptible customers up 6.8 for an overall increase of 2%. To put some perspective on it then, the average residential bill would increase by approximately $2.04 per month. In summary, we believe this settlement results in just and reasonable rates and represents a modest increase to continue to provide safe and reliable service to our customers. We have a plentiful supply of gas at very reasonable prices, and so when you think about our annual residential bill with the price of gas and you compare that to 2008, the average customer would actually be seeing a 25% decrease in their bill.
Ms. Cavisto, you referenced the settlement agreement. I want to show you it's been marked as MDU Exhibit Number 11.
Okay.
Is that a copy of the settlement agreement that was referenced?
That is correct, yes.
Summary? We have no further questions of this witness, and we tender for cross-examination.
Okay. Mr. Shue?
No questions, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
We have no questions.
Commissioner Kalk?
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. First off, thank you, Nicole, for being here today. I always appreciate when the President comes down as the first witness in the stand. So we'll ask you all the hard questions, and you'll deflect them to the staff.
Right? That works out great for me, Brian. Yeah.
No, that's what we do. I'm surprised that there's not any other questions. But I wonder if the settlement agreement obviously is going to take a lot of questions off the table, because when we talked about finishing in one day, my first thought was there's no way in heck we're going to finish in one day. But I guess if the settlement agreement takes away a lot of this, maybe it will proceed. I do have a few questions, though.
Sure.
And please feel free to answer or pass along whatever it might be. But you talked about one of the reasons is increased taxes. What taxes have been increased on MDU that have caused in part this rate case?
Yeah, as our investment increases, our property taxes would, go with that. So more investment would require more property tax.
So there hasn't been a particular tax that has been increased in the state of North Dakota that you're paying more for that tax, just more taxes in general?
Correct.
Okay, that makes sense.
And Garrett can correct me if I'm wrong when he comes up.
And then for operations and maintenance, where do you put in the costs of, I know MDU as well as this commission and others have worked really hard on pipeline safety and the protecting of your underground infrastructure. Where do those additional costs that you've incurred come from? Where do you put these into your rates?
Yeah, as we look ahead, and you're bringing up a very good point, pipeline safety and integrity is becoming very paramount in the industry, as it always has been, but there's been a heightened focus on that. And when you look at the PHMSA requirements that just came out, there will be new requirements that we will be subjected to in terms of inspection rules and inspecting our installation. And those costs we will have to pick up in O&M. One of the things that we did mention in the settlement agreement that I should have mentioned in my summary was, although we have decided to take the rate stabilization mechanism and withdraw that from the settlement agreement, the company is reserving the rights to come back to the commission and look at pipeline integrity and safety. A lot of states have provided for trackers for such things. They've also provided for where we've got O&M dollars that are needed and required to comply with PHMSA standards, that we are going to take a look at that and potentially come back to the commission as a way of providing recovery of those things. But anything that we've incurred to date with respect to O&M dollars, we would have put in this projected test period.
Okay, I like obviously you know what you're talking about in that area. So you couldn't pull out for this case how much of this has been dedicated to increased costs and for the pipeline safety at this point. It's just going forward what you're thinking more of?
Yeah, certainly if you looked back at our past dollars, I don't have the number in front of me. We could try to scrub for that, but quite frankly, most of what we do is providing safe and reliable service. And so a lot of our dollars, costs, as well as in particular, when you look at O&M, maybe there's a way you could carve that up. But I do believe that what we've spent in the past and even what we're going to spend going forward, there certainly is new regulation, new requirement, and what I would say a heightened focus on system safety. And so it is an area where we want to get our arms around that, look at what other states have provided, and as we noted in the settlement agreement, we'll be talking to the commission about that in the future.
Okay. And then on the little more detailed, when MDU adds positions, like let's say you have to add 10 new pipeline safety inspectors, how do you do that? Do you just add them in there and then come back for later cost, or do you have some quote-unquote fluff built in? You can just flex your number of full-time employees?
I would say fluff wouldn't be the word I would use.
if you take the bait.
New positions are, we are completely scrutinized those, to be honest. We really are in the business of providing safe and reliable service, but we have to do it in the most economical way that we can. So when we are going to add a new position, it is scrutinized before it's put in the budget, and quite frankly, it's scrutinized before we post it. We also look at replacement positions to determine whether it really is necessary to replace those. What I will say, though, is as I look ahead, like I mentioned here, and I probably can't say it enough, pipeline safety and the new regulations are going to cause some increases in our labor. And we will need to add some positions going forward from an inspection standpoint on the pipelines.
Thank you. And then I know we'll probably get into this with future witnesses, but you filed for $4.3 million. The settlement agreement is $2.6 million. Why the big change? Why would you settle for so much less than what you asked for?
Well, I think what you have to do when you look at the settlement is look at each of the various pieces in which we settled. And in a settlement, you can't really point to one specific thing. And so when you look at ROE, obviously we filed for 10, we settled at 9.5. I see that as a settlement of the grand overall revenue requirement, not that we think 9.5. Obviously we filed for 10. So, I mean, I think you have to look at the various pieces. On some of those, it was a timing consideration, and so we pulled it out of the revenue requirement, but over time we will see that realized. And so I think you got to look at it on a case-by-case basis, and at this point, when you look at the overall settlement, we were comfortable where we stood, but in each individual piece wouldn't necessarily be where we'd land, but when you look at it in the grand scheme of things, we were comfortable with the overall settlement.
Well, and that's kind of the... I mean, the settlement agreement is filed. It doesn't mean the commission, as you know, we're going to agree with it.
Mm-hmm.
But would it be better long-term for customers if you got the full $4.3 million today that would perhaps give rate stability for a 4 or 5 year period than a $2.6 million settlement might give us rate stability for another 18 months and we're back here again?
Correct.
I mean, is that the real issue of how this will play out, may play out?
Yeah, I think that to the extent that on a settlement we are, you know, reducing what we're getting in, to your point, that probably does add some certainty in terms of the timeliness of when we'll have to be back in for rate recovery.
Okay.
So
would you be interested
certainly
in a multiple-year settlement that keeps you out of here for 4 or 5 years?
Well, that was kind of the rate stabilization mechanism. Yep, that's really the proposal there. And in addition to that, we have seen activity across multiple states on these pipeline integrity trackers and safety trackers. And so they're not only tracking capital investment related to pipeline safety, but they're including O&M dollars related to it as well. A lot of states are doing that. That helps with regulatory lag and also prevents general rate cases. So those are areas, though, although we said in the settlement we're willing to give on the rate stabilization, we do want to come back and talk about other ways to look at ways to reduce regulatory lag, and so we're not filing general rate cases. There's a cost to those too, and that cost goes to our customer. So,
well, and I know you're familiar with the XL rate case that we had, and it we laid that out. Commissioner Fedorchuk had the portfolio then. I think she did a really nice job of laying out a 4 or 5 year period where it was built in, and I think sometimes that's the way to lay these out.
Right.
Otherwise, we're in this constant mode of every year we're back in here, we go through this, and it takes a lot of time and energy, and I don't think the customers are best suited when we don't lay out some long-term plans.
That is right, and you've seen that across the industry in terms of a lot of commissions and companies taking that approach, just because we are not the only gas company struggling with incremental investment related to pipeline safety as well as incremental O&M. So.
You talked on the ROE a little bit. So you, the 10.0 is what you asked for, 9.5. What if you've got more money but less ROE? What do you prefer, more money and a higher ROE? Or, I mean, it's a give and take. It's back and forth.
Yeah, I think over time, clearly what you've seen in the industry and as well as what commissions nationwide have looked at from an ROE perspective is interest rates have come down. And so we've seen a trend where ROEs are coming down. I believe into the future you're going to see interest rates start to rebound and go back up. And therefore, allowed returns will see the same phenomenon over time. Now, that takes some time. Return on equity, our witness did support the 10%. I'm comfortable with the 10%. I would support 10%. However, again, in the grand scheme of a settlement, we felt we were comfortable with 9.5. And as you know, 9.5 is where we settled in the prior two gas cases that we've filed in our territory.
Okay. And then the last line of questions, Nicole, is the rate design, who pays what, is always, it'll be an issue again. Why is it that the residential customers are getting hit harder in this rate case? Is it because there's more customers? Is it because of something that's been done in the past? It'll play out that the residential customers are getting so much more increase in this, but so why is that?
And I think that really goes back to our customer class cost of service study, and Tammy will be spending a fair amount of time on the stand talking about that. And so really that's how we look at it, is we look at it from a customer, you know, class cost of service study. We do that study and look at what those returns show, and then we feel we allocate it based on who's not meeting that overall rate of return.
So
we're basing it on that study, which Tammy will talk about more.
And just in a general sense, but in previous rate cases, did the other customer classes pay more than their share? And this, you're trying to true it up to where it's a true cost of service, where maybe in the past the residentials have been subsidized by other classes?
Well, right now, when you look at the customer class cost of service study, it would show that they weren't meeting their rate of return. And so it would show that, yes, I guess over time, there has been a subsidy going on. And so the way we allocated those increases was based on that study to get more in line with their rate of return per customer class.
So previous commissions have been okay with the different groups paying more than their fair share. And the question in front of us today is, do we levelize that across the board?
I think basically, based on our study, you would have to make that determination, yep, if you agree with that or not. Yep.
No, it's a big issue inside of rate design right now, and I think that, quite honestly, the country is going that way, where they'd reflect it out. So that'll be, I think, interesting if this plays out. But I won't show my cards too early, but I mean, the last rate case, I kind of held the line a little bit tighter on it. But as I've gone through more of it, and as you look at the companies, I think shifting it to the true cost is where we probably should end up at. So as all of you make your case, you'll have to show me differently on that. And I think that's it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Thank you, Judge. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you. I'm going to ask a few questions on your presentation and then go to your pre-filed testimony, ask you a few questions
sure.
from that as well.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, on your, I think it was the average rate base slide where it shows the, you know, significant increase in rate base since 2005 from maybe $22 million to today, or projected 2015, maybe $95 million or so. I'm looking at that chart, and from 2005 to about 2013, you more than doubled the rate base without a rate increase. And the first rate increase was then last year in 2014. So from 2013 to 2014, we're going not, you know, significant increases, but help me understand why you aren't able to continue that trend of withstanding the increases without rate increases, just using your growth to cover that.
I think the way I would describe it is customer growth will help you for so long. In other words, your investment, if you've got customer growth, the investment that you're putting into the system will offset that. That will be effective and keep us out of the regulatory environment for so long. But then there comes a time where our investment and our fixed costs to keep the system maintained and provide safe and reliable service will outgrow that. And so that's really what has happened. We have gotten to the point where the customer growth on our system has not increased enough to accommodate for some of our incremental investment. And when you look at like the Loop Line project in Williston, it really is providing for increased capacity, but also providing for better system reliability in that area. When we put that line in place, we're not getting incremental customers off of that, but it's the right thing to do. So, I mean, I think over time, you find yourself in a position where your customer growth is just not enough to offset the incremental investment.
Was part of it the case that your system had more capacity than was being used, and so it took a while for that capacity to be filled, and now with this significant growth in the Bakken region, you just had to grow
that could capacity. That could be a piece of it too. Yep.
Okay. Have you guys figured, or can, I'm sure you figured it out, can you share with me what percent of the growth is, or what percent of your increased costs are offset by customer growth?
I do not have that in front of me, so I'm not sure if somebody else does or not, but we could get back to
you. The company talks a lot about, you know, the percent and in identifying what you needed to ask for in terms of revenue increase. There must have been a calculation there that identified.
Yeah, and I suppose that would come through in our revenue requirement. So that's going to demonstrate what we think we need to get to a certain ROE level. And so that's really that calculation, that whole revenue requirement calculation, it'd be part of that. But if you're asking specifically like what percent of our investment was covered by customer growth, it basically would be to the, you know, the point that's not included there would have been included in our revenue requirement. And so I don't know that I have the details on that, but we could see if somebody could.
And it doesn't have to be precise, but even a ballpark would be helpful. Let's see here. You mentioned at the end of your presentation that a calculation, I think it was customers are paying in the total, their fixed charge plus their cost of gas, 25% less on average since what year was that?
2008.
Okay. So if I went back and looked at my bill, being an MDU gas customer in 2008, it's likely that it would have been less then. Less today than
I think
then.
We assumed like the average usage. Tammy's could probably help me with clarifying what was in that calculation, but we assumed the same usage, obviously, in 2008 as we would have assumed in the current year, and that's how that calculation was performed. So if your usage would have been happened to be higher in 2008 than it is today, there might have been a deviation, but we assumed the same usage and then looked at cost of gas and then what the fixed charges are for the customer.
Okay. The big variable there being the cost of gas.
Correct.
And gas prices have gone down, so customers are paying less.
Correct.
Does that comparison somewhat undermine or play to the hand, undermine your case, play to the hand of the interveners like the AARP who say, you know, point to the need for tools for customers to control their costs by variability? And, I mean, you're basically saying, because the cost of gas was so much less then, now than then, prices are less now. By going to the fixed charge, if you had done that in 2008, that probably comparison wouldn't be the same. You wouldn't be able to say that if you had had a fixed charge in 2008.
Well, if we would have had a fixed charge in 2008 and a fixed charge today, still the cost of gas would be less today than it was in 2008. So still the comparison would say that you have a lower bill today. And I think
would
really...
Would it be significant?
What's that?
Would it be as significant?
Not as significant, no.
Okay. All right.
All right. I think our view on the fixed charge is really there is a cost to providing service whether you use it or not. And that was, you know, Mike Diller also in his testimony provided the key points to why we believe, quite frankly, there's some of the same points we believe why a fixed charge makes sense in terms of recovering our costs.
Right. Okay. And to your pre-filed testimony. I have to take a little opportunity in these hearings just to learn. So on page 5 of your pre-filed testimony, you talk about the cost of gas. The second paragraph there, you talk about the cost of gas tariff, I believe. It's regulated by the FERC. Can you tell me what goes into the cost of gas tariff, or does somebody else can get into the details of that? So who decides and what goes into the calculation for what you guys can charge for the cost of gas?
Yeah, I would probably defer that to another witness other than to say that we simply pass through our cost. And so it is a simple pass through, and I think the testimony that I'm stating here is really getting to how the total bill for the average customer breaks down, and 71% of that is really just a pass-through of the costs that we incur, and then the remainder would be, basically the distribution.
So is there any infrastructure costs included in that cost of that gas tariff? Do you know, or should I just save this for?
Yeah, I would save that for, yep.
Tammy? Is that for Tammy? I just want to remind my.
Okay,
no,
sure, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Tammy or Travis, I think she's pointing at Travis. So.
She's pointing, everyone's going like this? All right. Well, it's included in your testimony, so yep. Someone must understand
yeah.
It pretty well. okay. In terms of the, this is a little bit like what Commissioner Kalk asked you. I'll play on it a slightly different way. On page 7 of your pre-filed, you talk about without a rate increase, the company projected its 2015 rate of return would be 5.25%, well below the cost of capital. With the significantly reduced revenue requirements that you've agreed to in the settlement, have you recalculated your what your rate of return would be in that?
I believe we have. I don't know if I have that in front of me, Julie, but I believe we do have that calculated.
Okay. I'd be interested in that if somebody down the road wants to get
into
that.
I might have it in my notes over here, but we do have it. Is it in Tammy's? Yeah.
Okay. We'll get it down. We'll get it a later witness as well. All right. You talk about on page 10 your O&M costs. And you showed this chart in your presentation at the beginning today as well. 13% increase in O&M since the last rate case. Is that how I'm understanding what you said in this? No, your actual O&M versus your projected in 2014 was 5% higher. And you're basically calculating a 13% increase in O&M. So can you explain what it is that's why are these costs increasing so much? Are you just hiring more people to get all this work done? Why is the labor and benefit costs the kind of the bulk of that O&M cost? Just dig in a little bit on O&M increases.
The bulk of the increase on the O&M side really does relate to incremental labor. So it would be from a competitive pay standpoint, the increases to existing workforce, but also adding positions, as we alluded to earlier, from a either a pipeline safety perspective or just incremental positions needed to accommodate the growth in the area.
And how far in advance do you guys project these costs and plan for them, just in general?
For O&M, we have a 5-year forecast from a budgeting perspective. So we try to look ahead 5 years. However, what I will say is we put a lot more scrutiny on the next year out.
Uh-huh. And how accurate are you finding your projections?
Well, in this particular case, when you look at the test year, I did look at that before coming here today, and what we plan to spend in 15 and where we're at year to date, we are very close from an O&M perspective as well as actually our investment. And so in this particular year in North Dakota, I'm pretty comfortable with our estimates. It is a pretty big effort company-wide to estimate where you think you're going to be from an O&M perspective. But as it relates to this particular case, our 7+5 information indicates we're going to be very close to what we put in the test year for 15.
Okay. On the first paragraph of this, page 10, it says, actual O&M for the 12 months ended December 13th came in approximately 5% higher than the projected 2014 O&M from the last rate case. What does that say? What does that mean?
That says that when we, so different than what I just said to you about this test year, we actually saw higher costs than what we had planned for originally. So actual
O&M. In 2014?
Correct.
And it was 5% higher?
Right.
So what would account for that significant discrepancy in your projection? I mean, why are these so hard to predict?
Well, I think a couple things. We've seen the growth in the Bakken. I don't know that anybody could have predicted the pace at which it did grow. And so I would say that a piece of it is just trying to manage, you know, how quickly we needed to ramp up in that area. And quite frankly, as we think about the Bakken impact today and the customers and the growth we're seeing there, it's a conversation we need to continue to have now in terms of the slowdown. And, you know, is the slowdown permanent? Is it temporary? You know, those are conversations that we need to have. But I would say my initial thoughts would be, for the most part, the change was labor and benefit related. And so I would say for the most part, it was just the timing of those employee additions that caused the discrepancy.
Okay. You feel you have a better sense of where things are going now than back then? I mean, the forecast is one area that I have concern with the company in terms of, because all of our decisions are based on predictions.
Right.
And if you're forecasting low, I mean, either way, if you're forecasting your revenues coming in less than they are, and we account for that and allow you a larger rate increase, then you're taking too much from customers.
Right.
And, you know, if you don't forecast enough, then you end up short. And, I mean, it's a tough balance to get at, and it comes down to the validity of your forecasts and how
right.
much we can count on them. And so this is one area where, you know, in the pre-file testimony, you kind of point to how it was off in the past. And I just want to understand how we can be more certain of the predictions in this case.
Yep. And we did take a look at that and scrub both our investment and our O&M that was presented in this case, and we are very close to where the numbers we have supplied here.
Okay. So you're tracking with actuals to this point in 2015?
We did a 7-month actual, 5 months plan analysis and compared that to what was in this test period for 2015 and are very close from an investment and O&M perspective.
And are those documents filed someplace, or is that just something you guys did internally?
Those are not filed.
Okay. We could see them if we decided we
yes.
needed to. Okay. Then one other question, I think. On page 12, you talk about, again, costs. Montana, Dakota works hard to control its costs, continually look for opportunities to create efficiencies and control costs. In spite of Montana, Dakota's efforts to control costs, the company sees cost pressures as the need to replace existing infrastructure and add new infrastructure continues. So tell me what you mean by cost pressures are one of the drivers for the need to replace existing infrastructure and adding new infrastructure.
Okay, can you, what page?
Page 12.
I'm sorry.
Line 15 through 17.
Okay. I think one of the things that we're alluding to here in the testimony at this point is as we make decisions on replacing or adding new infrastructure, we try to be very thoughtful, obviously, as we do those incremental investments as well as incremental O&M. One of the things that we have seen as we've been replacing and putting the infrastructure out in the Bakken-affected areas is cost pressure as it relates to subcontract labor to hire to get that work done, cost pressure to keep a labor force employed. And so although we do everything we can to control those costs, one of the things we have seen as we've developed and looked to the Bakken-related growth is some cost pressure just in light of the environment that's going on out there. You know, labor costs have gone up a little bit. Our subcontract labor dollars have increased as we've had to rely on subcontract labor to get some of these projects done. And so that is really the focus of the comments here.
So cost pressures are the need to replace existing infrastructure. You want to get it done sooner before costs go up more in the future because the costs are increasing so much, or help me understand.
Well, most of these investments we would say are needed investments, either from a capacity to serve a new customer. You know, we're really doing investments that we think are necessary to either serve an existing customer or a new customer, or replace pipe that we think is net. So I don't think for the most part, these aren't discretionary projects. They're mm-hmm. investments that we need to pursue, and we're seeing cost pressures as we pursue them related to the things I just talked about, either contract or labor dollars higher than what we've seen in the past.
Okay. I think that's that concludes my questions for
okay.
now.
Thank you.
Commissioner Christman?
Before we move on, in the settlement agreement, we do note, I'll just go back to your question on return on rate base.
Mm-hmm.
We do note at a 9.5%, a return on rate base is 7.34%.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Yep.
Go ahead, Commissioner Christman.
Okay. Well, you sure haven't deflected very many questions so far.
Yeah.
So keep firing away here. What's the distinction between small interruptible and large interruptible?
It would be volume driven. I don't have the exact.
What?
Tammy can answer that.
Tammy? Okay.
You shouldn't have started off with, you haven't deflected many questions.
Yeah. And my earlier opening statement about the history of the distribution delivery charge, who's going to do that one?
Tammy probably could handle that, too.
Okay. And the Mandan border station, and how much of that is the result of growth in Mandan or just maintenance needs in Mandan as opposed to the Heskett station?
Yeah, I would say it basically is dual purpose. So it'll provide additional for the Mandan community, but also for the Heskett. So that project is not complete yet, but planning is underway. So.
And so who's paying for it in your plan? Is the entire cost of that being distributed to the ratepayers? Or does some of that go to MDU itself as part of the Heskett growth?
That's in the Heskett. So it's carved out, the plant schedules I have anyway, and Travis can probably provide more feedback on that, but it's carved out of the investment.
When we talk about 71% of the average customer's bill is for the gas.
Yep.
Is that a calculation you made over a certain period of time that you can tell me, or is that at a certain cost of gas that you calculated that at, or how did you come to that number?
I am assuming we did that over a period of time, but somebody may need to help me with the exact calculation on that.
Okay, if someone will elaborate on
Kay.
That, so I know what that was based on. And lastly, we heard Mr. Kaufman's opening comments about being concerned about the rate classes. And as I recall, in the previous case, the discussion evolved into fixed income or low income people that really struggle with the utility bill each month, as opposed to those who don't have as much of a struggle with it. And who this change from a more of a volumetric model to more of a fixed rate model benefits. And it seems the argument has been that the old model benefits those fixed income or low income rate payers. But as I recall, there was some discussion that that may not really be the case, that actually it might be benefiting some very high income people who just have gas hookups for lake cabins just in case they happen to go there in the winter, or for fireplaces or things like that. So mm-hmm. I guess what I'm getting at is, do you have thoughts you want to share on that, or how do we get to the bottom of that? Who's most impacted? And specifically, one part of this is, are there any studies done that would indicate, with regard to a residence, what determines the amount of gas that they're going to use the most? Is it the size of the residence, or is it the efficiency of the furnace and the quality of their insulation?
I am not aware of any specific study that's been done in terms of what the driver is on, you know, now there may be one that I'm not aware of, but I'm not aware of any specific study that says what drives gas usage more, size of home or appliance. I'm assuming it's probably a combination of all those things. You know, certainly feel free to ask some of our other witnesses as they come up whether they're aware of that. You know, who it's going to benefit, the fixed charge. That one also is tough because, as you alluded to, there's cases where you do have some folks that you would classify, I guess, as high income that have dual homes that maybe, again, only have gas just in case they're going to occupy that second home. So there are arguments on both sides. I guess really what it comes down to for me is a theoretical argument in terms of we really do have a cost to serve regardless of whether you're using our service or not. And so, you know, that's really the basis of our request to go to a fully, you know, fixed charge rate, just similar to what you're doing with cell phone bills, cable bills, and a lot of the other industries out there where there really is, you know, one cost regardless of how much that is used. And that really is the case in our situation. When we put in services to serve a customer, we still have to maintain them. We still have to do leak survey. We still have to do all those things that are required on our infrastructure, whether or not the customer is using very little gas or a lot. And so really that's the basis for us moving in that direction.
If it's not a commercial operation, is a hookup for a garage or an outdoor fireplace or something like that that's separate from the home, is that still considered residential then if it's not a commercial business?
If it's on residential property, I would assume it's still residential. Yep.
Do you have any statistics on how many of those you have? Is that a common thing already, or is there just a handful of those types of situations?
I'm only guessing. I wouldn't say it's overly common, but I don't have the exact statistics on that either. I'm sorry.
Okay. I have no other questions. Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions of this witness.
Mr. Jernigan?
No questions.
Okay. Mr. Kuntz, any follow-up?
Just a couple things, Ms. Yep. Cavisto. In response to some questions by Commissioner Fedorchuk about how you've been able to, or how the company was able to avoid rate increases when its investment was increasing in the years, the early 2000s, are you aware of costs that were actually declining during that time period that would have offset certain investment increases, such as the cost of debt? What did the cost of debt do during those years? Do you recall?
Yeah, that would have come down as interest rates were coming down. I don't have an exact amount, Dan, but clearly that would have been lower
and
as well.
What about the cost of equity during that time period?
Well, I would venture to guess, just like nationwide, as we've seen ROEs fall, ROE potentially came down as well.
So even though your investment went from, say, like hypothetical, $1 million to $1.25 million, if your return on that was required in that
Correct.
Investment decreased, what's the effect in your need for a rate increase then?
It would decrease the need, yes.
That's all the questions I have. Thank you.
Mr. Hsu?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
Nothing. Thank you.
Commissioner Kalk? Commissioner Fedorchak? Commissioner Christman? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll just take, I think we'll take about a 10-minute break before the next witness.
Thank you.
All right, we're back on the record. And just before Mr. Kuntz calls his next witness, just a couple procedural issues. First, just with respect to order of examination of the witnesses, we'll just slightly tweak that, and the interveners will have the opportunity to question any of the witnesses right after examination by advocacy staff, and then we'll go to the commissioners. And then with respect to calling of witnesses, been advised at the break that FEA's witness has some travel constraints, and the parties all agreed and stipulated that after MDU calls its next witness, then Mr. Collins, FEA's witness, will testify at that time. So, and with that, Mr. Kuntz, you can call your next witness.
Mr. Sanderson will be handling this witness.
Okay, Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you. We'd call Ann Jones to the stand.
Okay. And Ms. Jones, before you testify, I'm required to give you an oath, advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It's a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. Being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Sanderson.
Thank you, Your Honor. Ms. Jones, could you please state your name and business address?
I can. It's Ann Jones, 400 North 4th Street.
And what is your position with MDU?
I am the Vice President of Human Resources, Customer Service, and Safety.
And could you briefly describe your responsibilities?
Sure. I'm responsible for the disciplines of human resources, whether it be benefits, employment, those types of things, our labor relations, as well as our customer service center in Meridian, Idaho, credit and collections in Bismarck, and then our safety and technical training for Montana, Dakota, Great Plains.
Thank you. Could you briefly describe your educational background?
Sure. I have a bachelor's degree from the University of Mary with an emphasis in human resources.
And what has been your work experience?
I've been with the utility for 33 years in a variety of positions, starting out office services, procurement, went over to WBI Energy for a period in the finance group, back to the utility in progressively responsible positions in human resources since the mid-90s.
And Ms. Jones, are you familiar with MDU's application in this proceeding?
Yes, I am.
And you've submitted pre-file testimony, which has been marked and admitted as MDU Exhibit 3 in this proceeding? Okay. Correct? And if asked the same questions as indicated in your pre-file testimony, would your answers here be the same?
Yes, it is the same.
Now, would you briefly describe and summarize for the commission the key points contained in your testimony?
Sure. I would identify them basically as being a conversation around our total rewards philosophy, staffing and recruiting, our customer service operations, and our continued focus on cost control within my areas of responsibility.
Okay. And could you explain what your testimony included with respect to this application?
I talked about the different programs and things we've done, similar to Commissioner Fedorchak's question regarding benefits and human resource areas and about our customer service center.
Okay. I have no further questions.
Mr. Hsu?
No questions.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions.
Mr. Jernigan?
No questions.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
No questions.
Commissioner Kalk?
Are these guys all getting paid to ask questions out there? I mean, I'm just saying, all right? Okay. All right, Ann, thank you for being here today. All right, let's get to it. The total rewards philosophy, when does that end? When they retire, when they leave, or how does that transition? I read through your testimony. Obviously, it's very well laid out. But how does it transition when somebody leaves?
Our total rewards philosophy is really around our active employee base. When you're an active employee, we plan for retirement, but all of our retirement plans are subject to change.
Okay, so let's say that employee X works for you for 5 years, and then they leave. Do they take with them a chunk of money, or is it just how does that transition out?
They have to be vested in our programs to take money with them, and so we have vesting processes. Otherwise, they would have their money. So if they're contributing to our health savings account, that's their money they're putting in that follows them. And if they've invested after 4 years, they're vested in our 401k.
Okay, and then once they're vested, then does the company have a financial responsibility to them forever or just at a certain point?
No, just because you're vested after 4 years, your money goes forward. But no, we don't have a responsibility for retiree benefits or for medical for any of our new hires.
Okay, so if someone works for the company for 30 years and retires, is there a future, is there a cost that you have to incur now as they get their retirement pension forever, or is that how does that work?
Yeah. We had a defined contribution plan or a pension plan that was frozen. So I have a frozen benefit under that plan. So speaking from a 30-year employee, I also have a 401k that is mine that the company has contributed to that will be mine upon retirement as an example. And then I will no longer have an option of retiree medical. We took away retiree medical.
When did you do that?
In 2010.
Was that because of what we did in the rate case back then, or is that something you were forward-leaning into as a company?
We were looking to the future and to the costs of some of these programs and made decisions to make changes. So I would have a RRA is what we have in place, retiree reimbursement account into the future to help me buy medical. We had groups of employees. We had grandfathered employees who still have retiree medical. We have employees like myself who will get a retiree reimbursement account. And then we have employees hired after the date we froze the programs who will not have retirement assistance in those ways.
Has that been a big issue, trying to recruit new employees, or is it not something they're concerned about?
We will forever hear about the fact that we froze our pension plan. Our current employees bring it up often. But I think we have other programs, and we work very hard to entice people to come to work for us. But it will always be an issue. It's brought up, especially with our bargaining unit.
Sure. I remember the previous rate case, the commission was different, three of us then, but we're concerned about the cost going forward of what it could be in rate cases like this. So do you feel you've reduced that cost now to where it's manageable, or is there no cost in this rate case other than those employees that were hired before a certain date?
We still have benefit costs. When we took away the pension, we have a defined contribution plan now where the company contributes into that 401k. So we've mitigated a lot of costs. We've made changes with our retirees, moving them from to supplemental insurance plans. We've done many things to help bring down those costs. Those things were going through my mind from the previous years when Commissioner Fedorchak was asking. You know, during those years, we made a lot of changes that we're seeing the benefits of as we go forward.
Because that was a focal point of one of our rate cases, because it was around the country these pension bombs were hitting, and I felt that you guys did the right thing then, but wasn't just sure how it would play out over time. So you're comfortable with the way it is right now?
Yes, sir, I am.
Okay. The last one, and maybe if this is not you, then let me know, but you're in charge, you said customer service, right?
Yes, sir.
So would you be the best person to ask about how you notify people with planned outages on service?
Yes, sir.
And please call me Brian. You're making me nervous.
I'd love to defer that.
Do you know particularly what case I'm talking about?
Well, we've had a few things in the local area, and I could use those as examples. But we do work in advance when we have a known outage coming to notify our customers through radio, through newspaper. We had an instance right after I took my role where we did reverse calling to customers. And we're continuing to...
How is that working with reverse calling? Because my daughter has never had a landline. She will never have a landline. How do you get their cell phones and emails? Is that a problem?
It is. Each time we have contact with our customers, we ask to update their records, so hoping to have the most current information. If the only phone they have is a cell phone, then it is identified as a home line, and that is what we use. You'd probably be happy to know we're working very hard right now on improving our outage maps, and also a mobile application is underway so that folks can go ahead and sign up to get mobile alerts as well. So we're in process on that at this time.
How much has your system improved over the last 5 years, 10 years, on the whole internet interactive dealing with your customers? Some IOUs have spent a lot of time and money, and it's paying off, I think. And quite honestly, I looked at your guys' system. It's good, but it hasn't made that jump to the next level, my opinion.
In the time that I've been in my role since 2013, we've made quite a few changes. A lot of things have been enabled by the fact that we've implemented a new customer care and billing system. And so we have all of our organizations, the four utilities, all on one platform. And now that we've got them all on one platform, we can move forward on some of these other things. But I go online and pay my bill today. I don't receive a paper bill in the mail. I'm able to go out, look at my usage, see my bill online, make my payments online. We're using social media, Twitter, Facebook, notifying customers of what's going on. We get more feedback through those channels now than most others.
So is there a protocol? Let's say a customer is living in Town X, and they're going to be have their service shut off for an hour. Is there a protocol where you get to that individual where you do an email if they have it, a phone call, the paper? I mean, how do you walk through the layers? What's the protocol?
Yeah, it depends on some of the areas. Sometimes they even go so far as to do door hangers, or even our service techs or linemen might even go door to door in some of those instances. I won't say with 100% accuracy that's always the step, but we certainly do the notifications as required through newspaper, radio ads. If they're vacationing or they're not in that area at that time, they may not get that notification.
And is that their responsibility to know it, or your responsibility to tell them that they're going to be out of service?
I would say we do everything we can to make the home aware of it, whether it's a door hanger or a phone call or whatever process we've gone through. But if someone is gone, you know, we may miss them on all accounts.
But is that your responsibility or their responsibility? Because I read the tariff one way, and I have an answer, but I wanted to see what your answer to that is.
My answer is that we take our responsibility seriously and do everything we can to notify that homeowner. But as a homeowner, it is my responsibility to make sure that I'm in touch with that utility or they have my most recent contact information so that contact can be made.
No, and the answer you just said is the way I understand the tariff as well, that if you're going to be gone, it's your responsibility to have somebody check in your home. But I still say anything we can do to make it easier. Should we give you more money in this rate case to improve your platform of customer interaction?
I would never refuse more money because it takes money to put these systems in place to make the system better. And ultimately, we hope for a payback for everybody through the efficiencies we gain.
Well, because we had a rate case, I was in the commission about a week, and we had Xcel Energy had all kinds of problems with their billing system. And we had a rate case where we focused in on them, and we gave them a big chunk of money just on that issue of billing. And now we sit here 6-7 years later, and it's really improved. So I guess I want to get in this rate case, what's the plan to improve your platform so it becomes, you know, completely interactive with customers, and they can have their cell phone apps. And what's your plan to get there?
We're actually in process on that right now. We have IT working on the mobile application, and I could not give you a rollout date. We just went live with Intermountain Gas on the customer care and billing system, so IT is very busy finishing up that system, but we've got some folks we've kind of pulled aside and said, we really need this mobile app. It's very important to the business, and as well as improved outage maps, and both of those have started. Completion date certainly would be spurred forward by having more resources.
Do you feel you have enough involved in this rate case that allows you to continue that process forward for the next 18 months at least?
I'm going to say yes, we do, that we have planned accordingly.
Okay, thank you. And then once the rate case is done, if you want to come back and do the periodic update of information, that would be great. But I'm serious about that. I think that that's one of the things as a monopoly you've got to prioritize, but you've got to get signals from the commission. And I, speaking for myself, I think we need to be investing in that, because when these customers get upset, I get that, but you make every effort. But every effort means so much more to different people now. You've got my father that will never get on a computer his life. So you've got to call him or do something with him, or he takes the responsibility. Then you've got others that they live and die by these things right here.
Yeah.
So, okay, thank you. I have
thank
no questions.
You.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
Well, good morning, Ann.
Good morning.
I just have a couple questions as well. And since Commissioner Kulk was focused on the notification thing, I'll follow up with a few of the things that he brought out. And that is, I'm pleased to hear you're saying that you'll have these mobile notification options. And in terms of all the various options for notification, when do customers sign up for those? And how do you explain it to new customers and then existing customers what their options and obligations are for knowing about outages?
Sure. All customers receive a new customer packet at the time that they establish service. So a lot of the information is in there. Our customer service reps can go through any of that information and identify it. And certainly we've been encouraging our customers to use our online or our web feature, if at all possible, to sign up for their bills and information there.
What about existing customers then? Like, as your options change, how do you notify existing customers?
We reach existing customers through our Facebook and our electronic means, through our bill stuffers that go out to the customers, through social media, just about any way you can imagine that we can find. There'll be a mass communication that will go out to customers, I would guess, by letter to their home addresses that have been provided when we do move to the mobile system.
Okay, good. So people will get a letter saying, we've changed our options for notification. Here's some new ones. And by the way, it's up to you to know.
Yes, exactly.
And we're not responsible for damages in case of an outage that you just didn't find out about. Will all that be? I think it's kind of important for customers to have that spelled out to them.
Okay.
Because that's the fact. That is the way it's laid out. And I think that we can't tell them that enough. And there are tools in addition. The mobile app. So if in a mobile app you're in an area where, say, your gas goes out and you're in Arizona for the winter, you would get a notification automatically that the gas is out in your home.
Yep.
Right?
Yep.
Okay. So that would be, you know, and then there's other options that customers can buy devices to test the temperature of their house that notifies them separately. But this would
right.
be a free way for them to know.
Yep. To log on to the mobile system and say they will accept messages and put in their customer information. Absolutely.
Okay. Well, I'm glad to hear you've got that coming and that you'll do a letter directly to customers outlining all the various options and their responsibility for knowing and finding out about outages that could impact their heat service to their house. You mentioned you were talking with Commissioner Kulk, and I didn't catch all of it because I was looking at something else, so sorry about that. You were talking about some of the changes that have been made by the company. And I think what you're getting at is it provides a better estimate for your costs. Can you kind of spell out some of those for me? What's changed in the last few years to give you a better estimate of your costs in the area that you're governing?
Sure. We have changed our medical packages. So we have a PPO program for medical benefits as well as a health savings account, certainly encouraging our employees to move to the HSA account because it teaches consumerism and first dollar becomes theirs versus the responsibility of the company. So we've done a lot of work in that area.
So your costs are more known ahead of time when you go that route?
They are. We still budget and plan for expenses, but when the employees are on the HSA, we don't start seeing a lot of those costs till about mid-year. Where on the PPO, we've got the first dollar costs. Mm-hmm. So we use our history to plan for our medical expenses. So we've made changes there. We've made changes to that for the retiree base as well. We had a lot of employees on our retiree medical plan, which acted as a secondary for them with not a lot of great coverage. But by moving them to a supplemental in partnership with age 65 benefits, they actually get better coverage. So the first word to the retirees was a little scary for them because of the unknown, and in fact, they're getting a better benefit today. So that was a really good change. As I mentioned, we froze our pension plan.
When was that?
Was that 2010. Am I saying the right year, Garrett? Yeah, 2010.
Okay.
You know, I'm trying to think of all the different pieces, and we've made so many changes. You know, we eliminated the employee utility discount, which was a very unique feature. Many years ago, the commission had allowed, we took it away. Employees no longer get a discount on their utility bill.
Could you also, would you be the right witness to explain the pension and post-retirement expenses in the settlement agreement?
I would ask Travis to speak to that.
Okay. And that concludes my questions. Thank you.
Right. Thank you.
Commissioner Christman?
I only have one thing left that hasn't been asked. But are you noticing an easing of what's required of you to retain or recruit employees in the last 6 or 9 or 12 months with the slowdown in the oil patch? And
No, we're not. We're actually seeing increased turnover at the utility, leaving the utility to go to the RECs, to the state even, to Basin Electric. We've seen more turnover in our general office than we've seen in recent years now, and we continue to have turnover in that Bakken area. People just do not want to live within that quality of life.
Even in these more recent months?
Yes, in these most recent months.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Kolk, go ahead.
One quick follow-up, if you could. I forgot to ask this one. Tell me again how it works if you've got employees that work on the regulated side and also the non-regulated side as far as their pay and benefits.
We don't have very many employees any longer.
Only a handful, right?
Yeah, that work on non-regulated projects. And so those are on a very limited basis. And I would ask accounting or finance to talk about maybe how those are handled. But we have so few anymore now that we've got out of the going into the home business.
Okay.
With our getting rid of our preferred service business.
So are we like somebody else, like less than 20 now? Or is it like just a handful of leadership?
I don't even know if it's that many. Okay. It's probably very, very few on extraordinary projects.
So it's not an issue then like it was
before? It's not.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Sanderson,
nothing
any follow-up?
Further.
Okay. Mr. Hsu?
Nothing further.
Mr. Kaufman?
Nothing, Your Honor.
Mr. Jernigan?
No questions, sir.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
No questions.
Okay. Commissioner Kolk? Commissioner Fedorchak? Yes. Commissioner Christman? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I guess at this time, as I indicated earlier, we're going to go out of order and allow FEA. Mr. Jernigan, you can call your witness at this time.
Thank you, sir. At this time, the FEA would like to call Mr. Brian Collins.
Okay. And Mr. Collins, before you testify, I'm required to give you an oath and advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It is a Class C felony punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, a maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. And being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Jernigan.
Mr. Collins, could you please state your name and your employer for the record, please?
Yes, my name is Brian Collins, and I'm employed with Brubaker & Associates. My business address is 16690 Swingling Ridge Road in Chesterfield, Missouri.
And in this case, who are you representing?
The federal executive agencies.
Thank you. And I noticed there was an attachment to your testimony, but could you please summarize your qualifications for this case?
Yes. I received a Bachelor of Science in Electrical Engineering from SIU in Carbondale, Illinois in 1993. I also received an MBA from the University of Illinois. I began my employment with the Illinois Commerce Commission in 1994 and worked there approximately 4 years as an economic analyst. I then was a planning engineer with the Municipal Electric Utility in Springfield, Illinois. I was there approximately 3 years and then took a position as a consultant in utility regulation with Brubaker & Associates in 2001. So I've been there approximately 14 years.
And have you testified before other commissions?
I have.
Could you give us an idea of who you testified before?
Yes. The Illinois Commerce Commission, the Minnesota Commission, the Indiana Commission, the Florida Commission, several others that are listed in my Appendix A on various utility rate matters.
And do you have what's been previously admitted as FEA 1 in front of you?
I do.
Is that the testimony you prepared for this case?
Yes, it is.
Are there any corrections you'd like to make at this time?
No.
Okay. If I were to ask you the same questions that appear in that testimony, would your answers be the same or substantially the same?
Yes, they would.
Okay. At this time, I tender Mr. Collins for cross-examination.
Okay. Mr. Koontz?
We have no questions.
Okay. Mr. Hsu?
No questions.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions for Mr. Collins.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sackle?
I have a couple. Commissioner Kolk, I have a couple.
Please.
Maybe three.
The judge talked all week about taking the witness out of order, but he didn't ask us.
So. Mr. Collins, I'm just wondering if you're aware of past commission precedent in rate design, the rate design portion of rate case decisions. That the commission has a fairly strong and maybe 100% precedent that if a company is deserving of a rate increase, no class was granted a decrease in that rate case. Are you aware of commission precedent in that regard?
I'm not familiar with that precedent.
And secondly, and related, similar precedent that all customer classes share in the increase. Are you aware of that precedent?
I am not.
That's all I have. Thanks.
Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. What the past commissions have done is no indication of what future commissions may do, though, however, right?
That's correct.
Tell me what you'd like us to do in this case.
Well, my testimony focused on the revenue allocation. My initial recommendation was to move rates to cost of service based on the results of the company's class cost service study. In the alternative, if the commission would require or desire to have some mitigation and not move fully to class cost of service, I recommended a movement towards class cost of service.
But the minus 1.6 that we just saw Ms. Gavista talk about, that's what you would like to have happen?
That is the agreed upon amount in the settlement agreement. It doesn't go all the way to my recommendation and testimony, but we felt it was a movement towards cost of service, and we were comfortable agreeing to the revenue allocation contained in the settlement.
Okay. So basically, you're sitting across the table from the other interveners. They don't see it that way, correct?
That's my understanding.
Fair enough. But, I mean, you speak for the agencies that you – tell me how you interface with the agencies that you represent, I guess, is what I wanted. Your opening testimony talked about who the FEA is.
Right.
So basically, is it just a minor Air Force base?
That's my understanding. It's primarily the Minot Air Force Base. There may be some other agencies that are also a part of the intervention group that I'm not exactly aware of at this time, but primarily the Minot Air Force Base.
Well, first off, I'm glad you're here, because we often talk about the Air Force Base in other cases, and it's always interesting to find out who they are, you know, whether it's a sighting, hearing, how it might affect them. So tell me the interface that you get from Minot Air Force Base that lets you know what their position is. How does that play out?
Well, I think they want, costs to be based on cost of service as much as possible.
But is this a meeting you have with the base commander and you go back and forth? I'm guessing it's their O&M people up there that you meet with. How do you meet with them?
Well, we have discussions via calls and emails with the group out of Tyndall Air Force Base. That is Mr. Jernigan's group. He reports to Colonel Degnan, who is responsible for the oversight of this case. So, we have discussions with them, with Colonel Degnan, with counsel.
Okay. And so the positions that I think I'm understanding is better from my background, not in the Air Force but in different service, where in the Marine Corps case, it's installation logistics that takes care of all the bases. So you're the equivalent group for the Air Force that lays out what policies might be for different bases around the country?
Right. The Air Force has hired us to represent their interests in various rate cases throughout the United States. And I have some meetings with the Air Force. My supervisor has met in person with the Air Force group to get their viewpoints on where they like what they would like to see as far as rates for their bases, both on a national level and in cases such as this. So,
what's your success from your viewpoint been in other states where you go in and true up the cost of service to what the rate design actually ends up being?
That's primarily our position in rate cases, that we like to have rates based on cost of service as much as possible, with the caveat that we recognize that there can be rate shock in certain instances. As far as our track record, really depends on the commission. We've had better success at some states than others. So when we've argued for cost of service based rates, so.
But to summarize, in your viewpoint and those you represent, that you're okay with the settlement agreement, you think that's fair for your customers that you represent, and anything different than that wouldn't be fair to the system, correct?
We agree with the revenue allocation contained in the settlement agreement. I'll leave that to the discretion of the commission to decide if that's an appropriate
amount. All right,
thank
you.
Commissioner Fedorchuk.
Thank you, sir, for being here. The company was in for a rate case a year ago, and at that point, I saw the percent, your cost of service and your contribution to your return on investment in your class, and was wondering why you weren't participating in the last rate case. So why didn't you guys get engaged before?
I'm not sure if I can answer that question. I don't know. I'm not sure, and I'll let. I don't know if Mr. Jernigan can interject. I'm not sure if our firm was hired at that time to represent the Air Force, and I'm not sure. I don't think I can answer why the Air Force did not get involved in the last rate case.
So you don't have any of the history on that?
I don't. I was
okay.
Not. Right.
So explain to me what, in the settlement agreement, it calls for a slight decrease in rates for your clients, customers. You said it doesn't go as far as what you recommended in your testimony. How far does it go?
I believe my alternative recommendation was to give the Air Force around a $43,000 revenue decrease. So this amount in the settlement is fairly close. It's within about $3,000 or $4,000.
Okay.
A year.
So is this a significant step all at one time to getting more focus on cost of service-based rates. Did you present an alternative that suggested halfway there in your pre-filed testimony, and does this go beyond that? Does the settlement agreement go beyond your what you recommended halfway to their respective cost of service, which would...
on a cost of service base rate, the Air Force would have seen close to, I believe that's about $85,000 in a reduction in their delivery service rate. My alternative recommendation resulted in about a $43,000
reduction. Okay, so your alternative was already the halfway step to getting to full cost of service.
Approximately for the Air Force, yes.
Okay.
So the settlement is a little bit less than halfway.
Is this common in other jurisdictions, in other states, where the Air Force is paying substantially more than their cost of service?
I'm not sure if I've actually seen an instance specific to the Air Force, a similar situation like this. So, but it is common in other cases where we've represented large industrial users, you know, where the rates are over-collecting their cost of service. And we've advocated, my firm has advocated for, you know, more cost-based rate.
And are these just, are these facilities just Air Force, like more commercial facilities, or are there residents living on Air Force bases that are also paying this rate?
I'm not exactly sure how the Air Force is handling recovering the costs that they incur on the base as a whole. I know in the past, in some cases, we've represented the Navy and the Army, and there has been instances where the base is billed a total amount, and then it's up to the base to collect from commercial facilities, from residential customers.
I would be interested in knowing if there are customers on the base, families who are paying this higher rate, or how the Air Force handles that. Maybe Tammy or somebody else can explain that. Okay, good. So do you entertain at all a more gradual glide path to cost of service? Your 50% is kind of where you're pretty close to under the settlement agreement. What do you think is like the bare minimum that the commission should be moving in this direction in this rate case?
Well, I think the settlement agreement is what the Air Force would like to see in terms of movement towards cost of service. We thought that was a fair and reasonable movement towards cost of service. It was close to our alternative position, so I think that's really our bottom line. So we signed the settlement agreement, so we thought it was fair.
I understand you like it because it gets you really close to where you're at, but I also see that usually people come in asking for more than they expect to get, assuming that they're going to have to negotiate a little bit, and you're getting really close to what you asked for. So what do you think is the bare minimum that the commission should agree to in moving in this direction?
I believe the bare minimum would be no increase.
Okay, so zero.
Zero.
Not a decrease.
I believe that was the company's original recommendation in their testimony. So.
Okay, thank you. Mm-hmm. That's all my questions.
Commissioner Christman?
Are you familiar with the rates being paid at neighboring bases like Ellsworth to the southwest, or right here in North Dakota, the Grand Forks Air Force Base to the east?
I'm not.
So you can't give us any kind of comparison as to how much over cost of service they're paying in comparison to Minot?
No, I cannot. No, we have not been involved in any of the, or I myself have not been involved in any rate cases involving those bases, so not looked at the cost of service, so I'm unable to answer that question.
Okay. No other questions. Thank you, though.
Mr. Jernigan, any follow-up questions?
Maybe just a couple in hopes of clarifying a couple of the questions that were asked before. Mr. Collins, before us today, you're here representing the federal executive agencies, correct?
That's correct.
And the Air Force is just one of the agencies involved in that, correct?
That's my understanding.
And the Air Force, the federal executive agencies also represent several other federal entities that exist within the service territory here.
That's my understanding.
Yes. So when we submit your testimony here, we're testifying on behalf of all of those agencies.
That's correct.
And when we look at what we are asking for here today, we are considering what would be best for the federal executive agencies as a whole.
That's correct.
And when we look at those other agencies, now you may not know exactly all of them, but would it be conceivable that they would fall into other rate classes that are in the rate design here today?
Yes, that's conceivable.
And as we look at those rate designs and we move closer to cost of service for all of those rate classes, you are testifying here today that is the more appropriate direction to move for this rate case.
Yes, that's correct.
Thank you. No further questions.
Mr. Koontz?
I just want to clarify a couple things, Mr. Collins, for the record. If I turn to the last page of your exhibit, FEA1, and these are primarily in response to questions by Commissioner Fedorchuk, the first table there is what your preferred recommendation was. Is that correct, of the FEA?
Yes, that was moving classes to cost of service.
So that everybody would be contributing to their cost of service.
Right. The classes cost of service will be recovered, yes.
And that was based upon the company's original revenue request?
That's correct.
Okay. And then the second column is what the company was proposing based upon its original request?
Yes, the middle table entitled Company Proposed Revenue Allocation. That is the company's proposal, yes.
And then in the third column is your alternative revenue allocation?
Yes, that's correct.
And this is the one that you testified was close to what the settlement was. Is that right?
Yes.
Can you explain for us how your alternative allocation compares to the settlement with respect to which columns, either an increased percentage or dollar-wise? And there's two different Air Force numbers on that particular column, and I believe only one reflected in the settlement. So could you explain your understanding of how the settlement compares to that particular table?
Sure. And just to also clarify, my table reflects only distribution revenues. It removes the gas cost of service, so the percentages that you see on my exhibit are not exactly comparable to what's contained in the settlement agreement, because I believe those are total costs, including gas. So with respect to the Air Force delivery class, at the bottom of my exhibit, BCC1, line 3 in the FEA alternative revenue allocation table, we recommended approximately about a $43,000 decrease in current rates, and this compares to the settlement agreement on page 5 of around $39,767 reduction. You mentioned at line 6 the Air Force Minot distribution rate. That is a contract that governs the O&M costs of the base's distribution system. And that is correct. That is not part of the settlement agreement. So that it's my understanding that contract will remain at $456,000.
Thank you. I just want to make sure the record was clear here in terms of how the settlement proposal related to your alternative recommendations, so there wasn't any confusion. So thank you for that.
Thank you.
Mr. Hsu?
Nothing further, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Kaufman?
No questions.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Yes, I have a few. Mr. Collins, did you prepare a class cost of service study for your analysis of this case?
No, I did not.
Did you review the companies?
I did.
Have you ever conducted or prepared your own class, cost, and service study?
I have in other cases.
I didn't see that specifically in your in the summary of your qualifications, but do you have one or two examples where you have conducted or prepared your own?
Yes, I've testified in Illinois in the Ameren Illinois gas rate case. There's one currently ongoing, and I think I've also testified in the last case where I basically took the company's cost service study and made some corrections, modifications to it. In the last Ameren Illinois rate case, I recommended a designed a domain allocation of T&D mains also with a customer component, and that is consistent with the methodology that MDU has advocated for in this case.
So you would agree that the allocations used in the study can definitely affect the results?
Yes.
So if there is a methodology that allocates substantially more to a residential class, that's going to result in return numbers that are substantially more in favor of the non-residential and lower numbers for the residential class. Is that correct?
Yes, to the extent that a cost of service allocation method uses a more volumetric-based allocation of T&D main costs, that tends to allocate more costs to the larger users, and that will definitely affect their rate of return as compared to a method that allocates costs more in designed aid demand and uses a customer component.
And you were speaking softly when you answered the question just previous, but is that a part of the MDU study that you looked at, and did you, and what were your conclusions? What, you know, of the allocations that MDU uses in its methodology, did you examine that?
Yes, I looked at the allocation on the designed aid demand and also the customer component, and the results of the study appeared reasonable.
Do you know if the study uses the minimum distribution system of allocation?
That's my understanding, if I remember correctly, from the company's testimony.
And that does result then in allocating additional costs to residential, is that correct?
Yes, when you allocate a portion of the T&D main costs on our customer component, that will allocate more costs to the residential class if you otherwise did not do a customer component.
And why do you think that's the right way to do a study?
Well, the utility incurs a cost to connect customers to the system, regardless of whether they take, you know, gas on the designed aid demand or any volume of gas whatsoever. So that customer component reflects the costs related to the location of customers and also the length of pipes. It reflects those costs that the utility incurs to connect all customers to the system. So those are costs that aren't collected in the designed aid demand allocation or in a volumetric allocation.
Okay. My final question is just a request for the party, for the federal executive agencies, and that is I think we should have a list of who we're talking about that's represented by the federal executive agencies so that we know which entities are fitting into which column on the return numbers. So if this witness doesn't know, I guess I would ask for a late-filed exhibit so that we can identify the entity and then what class they're falling into.
Mr. Jernigan, is that something that you can submit as a late-filed exhibit?
We certainly can, but it would I would just ask for a point of clarification whether we're actually asking for each individual office. I mean, without testifying, we're talking about every post office, every Social Security office, any federal government agency that exists within the area. And if I need to identify every single individual and their address. That's going to take me a little bit of time.
Sure. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, do you want to address that?
Well, I guess I wasn't envisioning that, but...
Well, let me interject, though. That was my first question, who these guys are, because I've written down federal buildings, Department of Homeland Security, post offices, DHS. I mean, we need to know the scope of who you're talking about, because if I'm thinking Air Force Base...
I would happily provide you with what you would like. I'm not aware that I'm allowed to testify and provide you that information directly.
No.
But if you would like a list of the agencies in general, I can give you that relatively quickly if you're looking for addresses and specific buildings and office locations. Well, that's going to take me...
Okay. What, if I may, I wasn't envisioning every post office's location, but I guess I was envisioning... 300 post offices, or 300 of this size and 500 of some other size. I mean, something to give Commissioner Calk and other commissioners some handle of what we're talking about. How many Homeland Security offices are there? I don't know. So I don't know that we need the addresses, but I do think we need to know how many we're talking about and then what class they fall into as far as how they're paying MDU for gas service. Because the statement was made that while the Air Force may be getting a break, others may be ending up paying more if they're small interruptible, for example. So I think to complete this record, we have to know that. If we need another witness, maybe we need an affidavit that would have we'd have an opportunity to question if necessary. I don't know.
So just as a United States post office, you're looking for how many post office facilities and what class?
Yeah, if they're all paying under the same rate, then I don't know that they have to be identified by big or small, but I don't know the answers to any of that. I'm just thinking out loud here based on what Commissioner Calk was questioning.
Okay. Mr. Jernigan, is that something that can be submitted as a late filed exhibit? Is that the best way to handle it?
Well, I can... It's going to take me a little bit of time to put it together. It'll depend on how long the commission is willing to let me get that together. I'm going to have to poll the other agencies and have them submit that information to me, which government doesn't move at the speed of light. So we're going to be working quickly to get you what you can. But I can give you a general list probably by the end of today. I cannot give you the exact number of facilities and their sizes without doing a significant amount of research that may take a week or two at least.
Sure. Well, Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, what do you think? I mean, do you want the more detailed submitted as a late filed exhibit within a matter of a few weeks, or is...
Well, I would defer to the commission. My inclination is yes, but what is acceptable to the commission, I think, is what's best. But for me, the issue was raised how much this party is paying under what rate class, and I think we need to know that.
Okay. Well, Commissioner Calk, go ahead.
I would just throw this out, that the MDU has agreed in this settlement agreement, too, so I would hope that you guys have done this. So, that it's a two-part treat, but I would like to know in general what facilities we're talking about, and I can envision the work session. I would view the Air Force Base as one entity. Then I'd like to know if there's 200 post offices and how that might affect, does this all of a sudden raise the cost of what the post office pays or lower it? I was envisioning the Air Force Base as the entity, and now that we've opened this can of worms, it would be nice to know by category at least. And I would, maybe Tammy can clean this up when she gets up here, but MDU signed off on this, so I would certainly hope you guys know what you signed up for.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
I think it's reasonable to wait 1 or 2 weeks for the full list. And get us the short list today if you've got it, or whenever you can. But, yeah, that's not an unreasonable amount of time to wait for that detail.
I can get you the short list quickly. The other list, I'm going to shoot for a few weeks. I will give you a better timetable once I'm able to actually talk to some folks about that. If we're lucky, we might actually have that with this utility, perhaps.
Fair enough.
So, yeah, if we can get a shorter list submitted before the close of the hearing, we can get that offered as an exhibit. But then we will still ask for the late filed exhibit, which will be the more detailed list that we've discussed.
Certainly. And I don't know if we're allowed to give closings or if we do closings or how you do that at the end
of
the session.
Yeah, closing.
I can certainly speak at that time, which I think is a more appropriate time for me to be actually talking as to who we are.
Right.
And explain that. Maybe I should have done that at my opening. I apologize.
No, that's fine. An opportunity will be provided for closings, but I think the list will be good as exhibit as well. So.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco, anything else?
I think that'd be great, and thank you, and I don't have anything else.
Okay. Commissioner Kolk?
No, just I agree with Commissioner Fedorchuk. I don't think it's a big hurry. Just get it here. It'll be a big decision point, I think.
I don't have any other
okay.
questions.
Nothing.
All right. Mr. Jernigan, anything further for Mr. Collins?
No, I that's all. Thank you, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Collins.
You were called Danette.
Okay. Mr. Kuntz, you ready for your next witness?
Yes, Your Honor. The commission, and through your order, allowed us to have Mr. Gaskey appear by telephone.
Okay.
I wonder if we might be able to call him at this time. I believe he's on the line.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Mr. Gaskey, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
All right. Before you offer your testimony, I'm required to give you an oath and advise you of the penalty for perjury in North Dakota. It's a Class C felony, punishable by a maximum fine of $10,000, maximum 5 years imprisonment, or both. And being advised of the penalty for perjury, do you promise to tell the truth in this matter?
I do.
Okay. Go ahead, Mr. Kuntz.
Thank you. And before we begin, Mr. Gaskey, I want to make sure you speak loudly so that you can be heard over the speaker system and the hearing room. First of all, would you please state your name and business address, please?
My name is J. Stephen Gaskey. I work for Concentric Energy Advisors at 1130 Connecticut Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C.
And what's your position with that firm?
I'm a senior vice president.
And what's your educational background?
I have a bachelor's degree from the University of Virginia, a master's of business administration from George Washington University, and a PhD in public utility economics and finance from Indiana University.
Could you describe your work experience, please?
Yes. I have worked with regulated public utilities and issues related to them for 38 years now. I started my career with a utility consulting firm called H. Zinder & Associates. After several years with that firm and another consulting firm, I returned to school to get my PhD, during which time I was coordinator for the Edison Electric Institute rate course, and I taught courses in public utility economics. Subsequently, I became a professor of finance at Trinity University, then returned to H. Zinder & Associates, where I had started my career. I have been with either that firm or my current firm for the past 27 years. Or is that right? No, 27 years, yes. I'm sorry. During that time, I have worked with utilities all over North America. I have testified in more than 100 proceedings and probably worked in well over 300 proceedings in various roles.
In this proceeding, Mr. Gaskey, you've provided testimony regarding recommendations on the company's cost of capital. Is that correct?
Yes.
And how long have you been providing similar types of testimony in regulatory proceedings? You mentioned, I believe, 27 years that you've been involved with your current and former consulting group. Have they all been related to or primarily related to cost of capital type issues?
I would say perhaps 60% of the cases that I've testified in have been cost of capital. And the other cases have been cost allocation, rate design, regulatory theory. A lot of my work is not in rate cases. It might be advising companies on building and financing new facilities or mergers and acquisitions competitive strategy.
Mr. Gaskin, your pre-filed direct testimony has been marked and accepted already today as MDU Exhibit 6, and your rebuttal testimony is MDU Exhibit 8. Do you have any changes to that testimony?
No, I do not.
And if I asked you those questions that appear in that testimony today, would your answers be the same?
Yes, they would.
And recognizing that the cost of capital has been a subject of the settlement agreement that's been filed and accepted by all the parties in this proceeding, but also recognizing the Commission's got, obviously, the authority to accept or reject that settlement, could you briefly describe the nature of your direct and rebuttal testimony for the Commission?
Yes. My direct testimony, I conducted a cost of common equity analysis in which I selected proxy companies that had risks similar to those of Montana Dakota's North Dakota operations, but that also were standalone companies that have publicly traded common stock. And we could use that information to determine a cost of capital that investors require actually in the market as these companies trade. I selected 9 proxies that each had at least 70% of their assets or income related to the natural gas distribution operation. After selecting those 9 companies, I did a discounted cash flow analysis, or a DCF analysis, on them. The DCF analysis is a standard method for estimating the cost of capital. It essentially consists of 2 components: dividend yield, which is simply the current annual dividend divided by the stock price, and to that you add a growth rate, and the growth rate is an estimate of the long-term growth rate that investors expect that company to achieve. The sum of the dividend yield and the growth rate represent the return that investors expect from a company, and it indicates the cost of common equity. In addition, I did a calculation like that for each of the 9 proxy companies, and I also added a flotation cost adjustment of 4% to the result, so that it would provide a rate of return that's sufficient to raise capital in if a company were required to issue common stock. I want to go back. I don't know if all of you have a copy of my testimony there.
We do.
But if you turn to page 34 of the testimony, there is a summary of my DCF results.
Be exhibit number 6, page 34.
Yeah. That will make it a little bit easier to talk about my analysis.
Go ahead.
Okay. As I said earlier, the expected growth rate that you use in a DCF analysis it is a forecast or an expectation by investors of what they think a company will do. For my analysis, I used 2 different methods for estimating the growth rate. One is the retention growth DCF analysis, which is in the first column of Table 2. or at least the results are. Retention growth is based on a value line forecast of what the portion of the earnings a company will retain and reinvest in the future to generate its growth. Sometimes we call that B times R. You've probably seen that formula floating around in some of the testimony. But one approach I used was retention growth. And that produced a range of between 7.83 and 10.53%, with a median at 9.12%. The second growth rate approach I used was to use, I call it a basic DCF analysis, and it uses the growth rates that investment analysts forecast for the companies. So I used that with my dividend yield to get the results that are summarized in that second column. That shows a low of 7.6 and a high of 10.48% and a median of 8.99%. And the final thing that I did was I blended the two together. I averaged the two growth rates, and that result is shown in the last column there. In order to infer the cost of capital for North Dakota, the North Dakota gas operations, one has to first look at the proxy companies and then compare the subject company, Montana Dakota Natural Gas Operations, to the proxy companies. And the MDU operations are considerably smaller than the proxy companies, so an important consideration for me was the higher risk of being a relatively small company, and also the fact that it serves a relatively undiversified local economy. There's agriculture, but the company serves an area that is heavily dependent on natural resources, and in fact is in the middle of what would be described as a boom cycle. That makes it somewhat risky if the bottom were to fall out of the oil and gas markets. The incredibly rapid growth in that area could reverse itself or just simply stop. So those were the primary things that I took into consideration when comparing the North Dakota operations with the operations of the proxy companies, and determined that MDU's North Dakota natural gas operations are overall more risky than the typical company in the proxy group. For that reason, I recommended a rate of return that reflects a cost of capital at the high end of the proxy groups or proxy companies that I evaluated. You can see from Table 2 that the highest of the companies are all had DCF rates of return well above 10%, and I think that overall the North Dakota gas operations of MDU are at the high end of that. If you turn the next page, I've got a second table, Table 3, where I did some additional analyses to test the reasonableness of the return. One analysis was to look at a risk premium approach. The risk premium approach uses the historical returns on common stocks, and the historical yield on bonds, and corporate bonds in particular, to determine an amount of a risk premium, and that's been normal over a long period of time. For example, for large company stocks, over a very long period of time in the past, the average risk premium has been about 5.8%. The return on stocks versus the yield on corporate bonds. So I added that premium of 5.8% to the corporate bond yield, 4.33%, and got 10.13%. And that essentially helped confirm the reasonableness of the 10% that I'm recommending. The small company stocks, which are more comparable to MDU's North Dakota operations, had much higher risk premiums historically. That's just one of the things that has happened, that over time, that small companies tend to earn significantly higher returns than large companies. So in that case, I added the historical risk premium of 14% for small companies, again, to the 4.33% corporate bond yield, and that gave me 18.53%, which is far above the 10% that I'm recommending. A second benchmark that I used was to conduct a discounted cash flow analysis of the S&P 500 companies. For that, I calculated the dividend yield for the companies and added the analyst projected growth rates for the companies, and then took an average. And the average DCF analysis for the proxy for the S&P 500 resulted in a 12.72% rate of return. And basically, we could think of that as the market average required rate of return, at least the average rate of return on S&P 500 stocks that's required. In comparison to that, I felt that the 10.0% return that I'm recommending was the appropriate cost of capital. It's less than the market average, but sufficiently close to represent the risks of a gas distribution operation. So for the most part, that is how my study was conducted, and that concludes my summary.
Just briefly, Mr. Gaske, looking at your rebuttal testimony, I would like you to focus on page 4 and point out to the commission what's shown on page 4 of your rebuttal testimony.
Okay.
And that's MDU Exhibit 8.
Right. That shows the authorized returns on equity for natural gas and distribution utilities during the last 2 years. Shows what was authorized in various ranges. I did it by 0.25%. So you have, well, the first range is 0 to 8.99%, and no commission has set a gas distribution rate of return below 9% in the last 2 years. The most common allowed return was in the 9.5 to 9.74% range. Over on the right side, you can see that there was actually one that was in the high 10% range. But for the most part, they've clustered between 9% and 10.5%.
I have no further questions. We tender this witness for cross-examination.
Mr. Hsu?
No questions, Your Honor.
Mr. Kaufman?
No questions.
Mr. Jernigan?
No questions, sir.
Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
I just have two. For how many years have you been doing MDU's cost of capital analysis?
20 years now.
And do you have a running count of for how many rate cases? Not just North Dakota. Just curious.
No, I don't, but it would probably be on the order of perhaps 20 to 25.
Thanks. That's all I have.
Commissioner Kolk?
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, sir, for your testimony. I just have a, excuse me, just a couple. Tell me again why you couldn't find any companies that were just like MDU. You said they were close. There's nobody out there that's equivalent to them, or you had to find somebody close to them for your proxy group?
The problem with doing a DCF analysis is that you need publicly traded stocks. And I was also looking for companies that were large enough that investment analysts cover them. So for the most part, the companies that would be exactly similar to the North Dakota gas operations either are not publicly traded or not widely traded and are not covered, and more importantly, are not covered by investment analysts with projected growth rates.
Okay, so why would you? How do you make the decision that you should pick companies that are bigger than MDU to compare instead of some that are smaller than MDU? Is that because they don't exist smaller than MDU with those caveats you said?
Yes, that is correct.
So I did not know that. Okay, so how does MDU become an A-minus company instead of a triple B-plus?
How did it or how could it?
How could it? I am understanding that MDU is triple B plus. Is that wrong?
That is correct. That is correct.
Okay, how do we get them to be an A minus company to get them in the A range?
Probably higher earnings. For the most part, the bonds are related to their Montana Dakota utilities operation. And so I think that's the primary thing that, the rating agencies are looking at in setting that triple B plus. Some of it is the amount of earnings. Some of it is the capital structure, although I think they have a strong capital structure. So it's probably a matter of better interest coverage in terms of the cash flow that the company generates.
Okay, I'm not a financial guru by any means, but so wouldn't that beg that we should do a higher ROE than a 9.5 if we want to get them to be a stronger company?
I believe so, but... So my recommendation was 10%, but in the context of a settlement, I believe 9.5% is reasonable. I doubt that will kick them into the A-minus range, but it will, I'm sure, allow them to continue operating the way they have been operating and maintain their bond rating.
Okay, and then just the last line of questions, that the last part of your testimony, page 36. Let's see here. You talk about that it has business risks that are well above average. If you've said that before, I've never heard it before in your testimony. Why do you say that? And I don't. How do we mitigate that?
Well, the primary reason I say that is the small size and the fact that it has a service territory that is heavily dependent on natural resources that kind of can be a volatile economy. It can grow rapidly or it can shrink rapidly. I don't think you can avoid that. The ultimate answer is they are playing the hand that they're dealt. They're providing service in that service territory and trying to meet the needs of the consumers. What it does mean, though, is that their cost of capital is higher. You can't change the risk, but you need to recognize the risk that's there and what that means for the cost of capital.
Have you been listening to the hearing most of this morning, or did you just dial in for your testimony?
No, I was listening this morning.
So did you hear the discussion back and forth about, you know, whether they should, how much the fixed charge should be increased, if at all? Do you remember that discussion we've had back and forth this morning?
Yes.
So does that tie into it all, where if a company has more assets in a fixed charge, that's better for its long-term strength, or does that not tie into it at all?
It ties into it a little bit, but not very much. If they're recovering the fixed cost in the, you know, the variable energy charge, the earnings can fluctuate fairly widely from year to year, just based on weather. And if there's a downturn in the economy, they can go down rapidly. But the company would come in pretty quickly, I think, and file a rate case. So it reduces their overall risk a little bit, but I think investors look at a longer-term proposition, and so they're concerned about year-to-year fluctuations, but the bigger risk is that you have problems in your service territory, or that you have accidents or safety risks, or that the company somehow extends itself too much in terms of borrowing.
Okay, and then just two more questions, I think. I sometimes have a hard time reconciling how they can be at risk when they're a regulated monopoly, that they really can't be at risk, because if things go south, they're going to come back in here. How do I relate those two statements? They're at risk, but yet I know they can come back and request more money if they have trouble. What are they at risk for?
They are a regulated monopoly, and as such, they tend to have less risk than a lot of other companies in the economy. But what concerns investors is that they can come back to the commission, and the commission might not authorize the return. Commission might set the return too low, or the commission might disallow various costs, for any number of reasons. Within the utility industry, you see this happen, not every day, but it happens often enough that it's a real risk that some utilities go bankrupt, and it's not something that investors expect out of the utilities, but they know it's a possibility. PG&E is a good example. New Orleans Public Service, after Katrina, is an example. Public Service Company of New Hampshire is an example. There are a pretty good number of examples of utilities who are regulated monopolies who also went bankrupt.
Okay, so I think what I heard you say in Kalk terms is that the stronger a company is, the less risk for customers and price swings down the road. The last thing, how do I explain to the guy in the street that's getting 1.5% interest in their savings account why I should give a company anything more than like 3%? How do we reconcile this to the guy in the street?
Well, there's a huge difference between investing in a CD or something like that, which is a very short-term, usually pretty safe asset, and going out and putting distribution mains in the ground that are going to be there for 30, 40 years before you get your money back, and you don't know how the economy is going to change. Common stocks just require a higher rate of return, and so because they're much riskier. And so the explanation for the man in the street is that there is considerably more risk in common stocks. In the last few weeks, we've seen the overall market drop 10%, whereas someone who buys a CD has a pretty good assurance that in 90 or 180 days, if they put $100 in, they'll get $100 back.
Okay, makes sense. And then I think this is the last one. MDU has a history, as most of our investor owns, of now coming in for advanced determination of prudence to reduce their risk. If companies come in for ADPs, does that have a correlation that perhaps they should be allowed to have a lower return on equity because we've already taken away some of that risk? Or isn't there a correlation between ADPs and what they should be allowed to earn?
There probably is. I haven't done a study to see if the gas utilities in my proxy group also have ADPs. But if the proxy group is filled with companies that have ADPs and MDU has ADPs, then you're on an apples-to-apples basis and don't need to make any adjustment to the results.
Okay, thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak?
Thank you, Mr. Gaske. I'll kind of stick with the general approach to, like, Commissioner Kalk. We can get caught up in the weeds of all these formulas, and I want to stay focused on the big picture. So give me your rationale or your description of what the risks are for the company and its customers of us setting an ROE that's too low.
Well, for the company, it obviously hurts the value of their investment, but it also means that their ability to pay off their debt and maintain sufficient coverage ratios on their bonds could be affected, in which case a lot of times lenders will have covenants that say if you can't generate enough cash flow to have 2x your required interest coverage, then your bond comes due unpayable. I don't know.
You seem to be fading out. Did you move away from your phone a little bit or
no? I hope not.
We can't hear you as well.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There you go. That's better.
Oh, okay.
Stay close to your mic on your phone. So,
all right.
Okay, you said it hurts the value of investment. It makes it threatens their ability to pay off debt.
Pay off their debt, so overall, it makes it a less desirable investment. From the standpoint of your customers or the consumers, it makes it harder for the company to attract capital. So if it needs to invest a lot of money for either safety or for growth, which MDU currently is doing, if it can't attract capital easily, it won't be able to make those kinds of investments. It will have to figure out some other way to provide the service, but in the long run, quality can suffer.
Has that ever happened in the time that you've worked with the company? They haven't been able to attract the capital that they need to make their investments?
No. I've seen other companies go through that, and and it's not a pleasant sight.
You've seen other utilities, but, regulated utilities, go through that?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
But I've seen it a number of times, but the most obvious one is the Pacific Gas and Electric bankruptcy about 15 years ago. And they didn't have enough money to purchase power to deliver to their customers and ended up with blackouts in their service territory.
Hmm. All right. You talked about some of the recent drops in the market in the last week. How are utility stocks performing relative to some of the other things, and how would you kind of classify utility stock investments right now in terms of their appeal to investors?
They have only modest appeal right now. Throughout this year, the overall prices have tended to drop. Mr. Rothschild actually had an exhibit in his testimony that showed that this year the utility stocks have dropped more than the market as a whole. The lower price, generally, at some point the price gets low enough that they become an attractive investment, but that lower price also means that investors are expecting a higher rate of return out of the companies.
And why are they dropping in appeal? What factors?
I think the overwhelming factor right now in the market is the expectation that the Federal Reserve will begin raising interest rates. And as if interest rates on bonds and other instruments go up, investors will tend to buy bonds instead of, say, buying the utility stocks, and as a result, they'll sell off their utility stocks and buy bonds that have higher yields. So far, the Fed has not raised interest rates, but there's been speculation for about 8 months now that they're about to do it, and I think that's had a major impact on all of the stocks in the market, and a particularly strong impact on utility bonds, or I mean, on utility common stocks.
Utility common stocks are somewhat comparable than you're saying to bonds because they're less risky than other stocks, but produce a greater yield than a bond and under low interest rate scenarios.
Overall, they do present less return than regular common stocks, but the impact of higher bond yields plays out for all stocks, but I think it plays out more for utility stocks because they tend to pay higher percentage of their earnings out as in dividends than most of the common stocks in the market. For example, they pay out about 4%, and the average company pays out about, unregulated company pays out about 2%. So investors do look at utility stocks as a source of cash flow that will pay a dividend on a regular basis. They reinvest some of their money, but not nearly as much as other types of companies.
Okay. And then one last question. How has MDU treated its investors in recent years? Has it been a good investment?
to tell you the truth, I don't have a good answer to that. I don't know.
Based on your calculations of in all the testimony you provided, you can't say how you think this company has performed?
It has bounced around, and I think they have, in the past year, been torn in a couple of different directions. So it's kind of an interesting question. I think that the stock price, like a lots of stocks, has been going down. I don't know if that answers your question.
Not really. The stock price is going down, so it's not as great of an investment. But it is more appealing to investors now because it's lower price, but they want a higher return.
Right. Well, for example, in the last 3 or 4 months, the stock price it's probably gone down 50%, 40%, something like that. It has not been a good investment in the last few months.
All right. So how important is this, getting the right ROE then, the 9.5 versus 10% that is the difference between the settlement agreement and what you've proposed, to maintaining the company's strength in the marketplace?
I think in the context of the settlement, it's probably reasonable. In the settlement, they probably get certain things that they're asking for, and one of the things they give up is some of the return on equity. I'm not privy to everything they got their ultimate calculations and as to why they accepted the settlement. But I have to presume that if they're satisfied with the overall package, then it should be a reasonable settlement.
Okay. Thank you.
Commissioner Chrisman?
I only have one question. It seems like most of your testimony has encouraged the original proposal, the 10%. Are you recommending to us that we accept this settlement and go with 9.5%? Or are you testifying that this should be rejected in favor of looking at a higher rate?
No. In rate making, a lot of times there's a heavy focus on the return on equity. But at the end of the day, the thing that's important for both the company and investors is the overall dollars that the company is allowed to collect. So whether in the settlement you get those dollars as a return on equity component to the rates or something like pension benefits or depreciation rates or operating and maintenance expenses that are allowed, it's the overall result that really is most important.
Okay, no other questions. Thank you.
Mr. Kuntz, any follow-up questions?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Hsu?
Would you characterize this as a hard science cost of capital analysis?
Semi-hard. we have techniques and we have data that we can look at, but the estimation of rate of return on common equity is not a simple calculation, and so it does require judgment.
Right. So it takes judgment, and so people could have possible different conclusions in their judgment. Correct.
That's correct.
Thank you,
Mr. Kaufman.
No questions,
Mr. Jernigan.
No questions.
Okay. Ms. Jeffcoat-Sacco?
Just one. How much impact does the gas, the North Dakota gas operations of Montana Dakota Utilities, the division, have on the stock price or value of MDU Resources?
Very little.
Thank you.
Commissioner Kalk? Commissioner Fedorchak? Commissioner Chrisman? Okay. Mr. Kuntz, anything further for the witness? Okay. Thank you, Mr. Gaske.
Thank you.
I think we'll break now, probably start up again at 1:15.